You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Oh, look, it's Derek Davison and Danny Besner, the American Prestige Podcast, and I'm Robert Wright of the Non-Zero Podcast, and this can mean only one thing. This is one of the occasional collaborations between communist peacenicks and neoliberal peacenicks.
It means the continued breakdown of Western civilization is what it means.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello, Bob.
How you guys
doing? You would describe yourself as a neoliberal?
Well, no, but I don't think you guys probably wouldn't describe yourself as communist, would you? Would you? I mean, I don't know the technical terminology for what
probably
you are.
No, probably not. Yeah. I mean, describing oneself as a communist is like describing oneself as an Aryan Christian. It doesn't really exist anymore, so it's just in your mind. I would say, Derek, what, socialist? Probably more social democrats than a democratic socialist, even though there's not that much of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, the distinction is lost on me, so I'll just, I'll go with whatever you say.
Yeah, so social democrats here.
But we are united in the mission of restraint. We are restrainers. Do you accept that
united.
Label as far as your foreign policy?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So, look, I bring good news to you guys. Yesterday, Trump did not use our tax dollars to bomb a boat in the Caribbean that may or may not have drugs and then go back and bomb again to make sure any survivors are dead. Instead, he used our tax dollars to seize a Venezuelan oil tanker, you know, also almost certainly illegal, almost certainly a violation of international law. And I would add that the ostensible purpose of it is to enforce unilateral sanctions that have the effect of raising the price we pay for gasoline. But no one was killed. And I think that's an improvement. I think we may be moving toward a kinder and gentler version of the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which I think is an actual phrase, right? In the national security strategy document that got Europe so riled this week.
Right, the Trump corollary.
I don't know if it's in the document, but they're definitely calling it that. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That was Roosevelt in 1904. Am I remembering that correctly? Basically giving a police power to the United States. Because famously, the Monroe Doctrine written by John Quincy Adams, actually, doesn't actually refer to enforcement mechanisms. The Monroe Doctrine refers to basically just stay out of the Western Hemisphere, Europe. And of course, famously, Europe didn't do that for most of the 19th century because the United States was actually quite weak. And this is, I haven't thought about this in a while, but I think it's the second Venezuelan crisis, Derek, am I remembering this correctly, that leads eventually to the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which essentially gives police power. And several internal Latin American wars that European powers get involved in over the course of the 19th century. And then Roosevelt is like, no, we're going to actually like use military force to make sure that you don't intervene. So this, I guess, is just kind of the same thing, but more without any reference to European power, I guess, is this Trump corollary.
It's true that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
Yes. I mean, in this instance, at least.
You know, we talked about this in another interview that we did a couple of days ago, but it's like the devolution of this from like a statement that European countries should stay out of the Western Hemisphere to United States is going to exert a policing power over the Western Hemisphere, which is a little more openly interventionist, but still casts it as like we're going to protect the Americas from outside intervention, to Trump, which is just like we're going to plunder this region for whatever we can get out of it. Like it's an interesting,
well,
I think,
but not
line
even.
To trace.
I mean, I don't see. I question whether this has even that much coherence. The Trump, whatever.
I mean,
calling,
it's not coherent. Nothing he does is coherent. But
because,
yeah,
because I mean, look, I mean, here, you know, supposedly the rationale for us like not being as preoccupied with whether Russia or anybody else is authoritarian is Trump's idea. And, you know, a lot of this I align with is that, like, you know, it's a fool's errand to try to transform countries internally. Never works. Why don't we focus on our relations with them, their relations to the outside world, to other states? And let's try to have a mutually beneficial relationship with as many countries as possible. Fine. But that's not what's happening with Venezuela.
If right, were, exactly.
You like, say, okay, yeah, we're fine with you being an authoritarian, but let's just not let commerce between us get impeded by anything as stupid as unilateral sanctions. But instead, we impose the sanctions explicitly on the grounds, and this was done by Trump in his first term, on the explicit grounds, you know, basically neocon grounds. They're not democratic, they're authoritarian, that's what we're doing. So this, I'm sorry, I don't have the same gripe that the Europeans have about the national security doctrine. You know, this comes out every 4 years and the new one just came out because they're just complaining to some extent about trash talk in the doctrine. It's not not all that substantive, but and there's also substance they don't like maybe. But the thing is just his foreign policy is incoherent on a larger scale. Like, are there any thoughtful people in MAGA claiming that this whole thing adds up? I mean,
I haven't seen that, Derek. Have you?
So,
I don't think
no.
they give a shit. Yeah, they don't care.
I mean, like the people yeah. who, there were very few people in his first term who tried to make a coherent sense out of his foreign policy. Elbridge Colby, I think, was the most prominent, and he's like, you never hear about him anymore. Like there was a, you know, right. some a stir when he was made Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And he the only time I hear about him now is when somebody else in the Pentagon has clearly like planted a story bitching about Elbridge Colby with some, you know, newspaper or something. You hear about him in that sense, which is unusual for like, you know, the number four position at the Pentagon, number four or five. You don't usually hear about people at that level, but you do sometimes hear about Colby, but it's always in this negative light, like, oh, he's, you know, like fucking up AUKUS, or he's doing, you know, he's screwing around with this, or, you know, we blame him for that. You don't really get anything proactive out of him or people like that trying to make sense out of what Trump's doing.
No. And in fact, I assume, I mean, he tweeted or something approvingly this week about something that Trump did, presumably the national security strategy. But I would think, do we know what Colby thinks about these relaxing the chip export controls, which Trump also did this week? He's going to let China buy these H200s.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably NVIDIA. Against it. I mean, like this was, to my mind, one of the most interesting things about the national security strategy is that it recognized the material reality on the ground, that the United States isn't going to be able to remain hegemonic in East Asia. And Colby's whole thing is ensuring that the United States takes a very serious confrontational position with China. And I think, you know, facts and reason are winning out, or really the material reality is winning out there. So, I mean, I'm sure Colby isn't happy with it. He definitely, I would imagine, wouldn't be happy with it, but it's probably a positive development insofar as it helps avoid further conflict and confrontation in a basically meaningless, in a way that would otherwise be meaningless, because obviously China's going to dominate East Asia. The United States is not going to be able to prevent that. So the question is, how do we deal with that obvious regional hegemonic transition? And I think insofar as it goes, it's moving in the positive direction, in a more positive direction than I would have imagined, given the realities of policy in the last several years.
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, the political consequences. I mean, it's funny. First of all, I should say a couple of people have said after Trump relaxed these chip restrictions to me, like, oh, you must be happy. Or one of them said, you're the only person in the world who's happy, because I was thought of as being a big champion of this.
I think I didn't really feel the happy. People at NVIDIA are pretty happy. I don't know about that.
Oh, like, yeah.
You'd be the only person.
I mean, well, see, what I had been doing is saying, like, no thought has been put into these chip restrictions. I mean, for example, it's very clear that the effect. Okay, so the policy had been you exclude China from all of the world's most advanced AI chips because they're all made in Taiwan. And it's very clear that this has the effect of increasing the chances that, or at least decreasing China's disincentive to invade Taiwan, right? Because it had been this great, almost like that factory, those chip factories had been a kind of mutually assured destruction. we were both getting so many vital microchips out of them, okay, that nobody wants to start a war there because everybody knows that the loser of the war is going to blow up the factories. Or apparently we could even imprint, the West could disable them by remote control almost because the machinery is so dependent on ongoing tech support. But in any event, everybody knows that if there's a war over Taiwan, the winner does not have access to factories that actually produce chips. So that had been a deterrent to war. And now we've created a situation where the effect of that factory is to give America a big edge in what America itself says is the race for ultimate global hegemony. That's what we're saying, right? Whoever gets to AGI or superintelligence or something first is the global hegemon. Some people like Dario Amodei of Anthropic say, yeah, we should use this to bring China to their knees. So there are explicit neoconish threats in the air. And obviously, you know, I'm not saying attacking Taiwan, it makes attacking Taiwan likely in the sense of more than 50%. But it obviously, if you believe that humans respond to incentives, and you know, it increases. And my complaint was just like, nobody talks about this. It was just not in the foreign policy discourse. And yet everyone supported the policy. And there were other things I didn't like about it. I mean, I'll quickly mention the other one is that the quote AI safety community, I don't want to, I mean, look, they're great. They're great.
We love them.
Well, no, I do, because like me, they believe that this technology is, should be approached with tremendous caution and it shouldn't be full speed ahead. But most of them are, for whatever reason, China hawks, which is just weird, because if you understand much about this technology and think it needs to be subjected to governance, you appreciate that the governance is going to have to be international. Can't work otherwise. There's going to have to be better relations with China. There's going to have to be cooperation. But these people, some of whom are like obsessive doomers, are like, just seem to wall that consideration off and like, let's make China feel as threatened as possible. You know, let's really double down on the analogy with embargoing Japan's oil before Pearl Harbor, right? Let's just make this as much like that as possible. And so my objection has just been like, the AI discourse is completely impoverished. There's just no, there's almost no intelligent geopolitical input. And that's my frustration. I worry now that the effect of this, as it's playing out, is going to be to intensify China hawkism, because Trump's association with a new policy will alone ensure that it is denounced by almost everyone in the foreign policy establishment. So I don't know that this isn't, you know, a good thing. It's just that the support for it was devoid of intellectual underpinning.
I think you would know this
support
better.
For the prior policy. Sorry.
No, Bob, you would know this better than either of us, I think. I do remember, by the way, like there was some talk about the deterrent aspect of like TSMC when Trump started this onshoring stuff, like we're going to make the Taiwan, you know, the Taiwanese manufacture chips in the U.S. Now, they weren't going to do that with the most advanced AI chips, I guess, to maintain, which maintain deterrence. But I still remember like there being a discourse about like, doesn't this defeat the purpose of making the chips on Taiwan? But anyway,
it's like, in the air, but there's just very little intersection between that and the discourse about this policy.
Yeah.
And but you're right. I mean, look, it wasn't going to be the most advanced AI chips, because for one thing, it's just not clear we're capable of that. It's that's what the Taiwanese say. They come over here and they go, I'm sorry, we've just sized up your labor force and you guys can't.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have to import like 1,000 people from Taiwan. And so but the aspirations were not that high for the.
But so you would probably be able to answer this better than either of us. The question that I have is, let's say you just put a flat embargo on China getting any of these advanced chips. Like, we've already seen Chinese companies innovate.
It's ridiculous.
Around those
I know
bands,
what you're going to say. Yeah,
right?
It's fucking ridiculous.
Like,
this is,
they
I
produce
mean,
their
yeah,
own chatbot.
Something to say when you're done. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
they produce their own chatbot that works basically seems like as well as Grok or ChatGPT or any of these things. And I realize that's not like AGI. That's not the really serious stuff. But the assumption that, like, if we embargo these chips from China, and there's a whole nother thing about the supply chain that I would like to get into as well, but just leaving it on this issue, like embargoing China from getting these chips, that assumes that the Chinese, like Chinese companies, Chinese leaders, the Chinese government are just going to throw up their hands and say, oh gosh, I guess we're never going to have AGI now because the West is blah. Like, they're not going to do anything technically to try and you know, get around that or innovate around that. It just seems ridiculous to me, but in keeping with the whole kind of ethos of the U.S. foreign policy community to treat other countries and other people as two-dimensional, you know, reactive only forces who can't do anything for themselves. But I don't know, is there a reason why that embargo would work and China wouldn't be able to do anything about it?
After Bob answers, I want to say something quickly, but Bob, please answer Derek's question.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
China's doing something about it. I mean, on your first point, yeah, China's large language models, they're not as good as the leading edge American ones, but they have shown, and most famously with DeepSeek, this open source or open weights model about, I guess it was about, was it a year ago? Anyway, could have been two. It was this time of year. But most famously with DeepSeek, they can do a lot with a little. I mean, they have really good engineers. And I mean, look, you just look at the bylines on the important AI papers that come out from American labs. Half of them are Chinese names, you know, people who came from China. Maybe not happen a lot. There's a ton of talent there. And DeepSeek showed that with relatively little in the way of physical chip resources, they can do a lot. Now, as for your larger point, Derek, yes, absolutely. This has intensified manifestly the Chinese drive to become self-sufficient in making advanced microchips. That was a long-term aspiration anyway, but it's very clear there's been really significant acceleration. Basically, Huawei has been anointed as kind of de facto, I think, I hope I'm getting this right, kind of de facto head of an largely informal consortium of lots of Chinese companies. And yes, they are making strides. It's a real challenge because the chip making equipment, you know, is also being denied China. And that stuff, there's only one company in the Netherlands that knows how to do it, you know, for the most advanced chips and so on. So it could be a while, but Huawei is clearly making progress. And, you know, you can compensate for relative deficiencies at the level of chips by A, stringing more of them together in particular ways, and B, having a lot of raw energy, you know, power. And China has a lot of that. They don't have to worry so much about the efficiency, the energy efficiency of the whole thing. So, yeah, they are making strides faster than they would have otherwise in the absence of our chip restrictions. And that's going to lead to a situation where, you know, in a few years, it may well be the case that they are self-sufficient top to bottom for chips, okay? Most advanced to least, and we're still not. It's very unlikely that we will be in 3 years. And what does invading Taiwan look like then? Much more appealing. Much more appealing. They don't lose anything. And so, you know, it's just, and I'm not, look, it's a very complicated issue. I just would like to see some evidence that the kinds of questions
what's so complicated
I'm raising
about
were raised
it.
By someone.
Wait, Bob, what's so complicated? I mean, this is what I wanted to add. Like, Bob, you've been covering this for a few decades now. Is this the most intellectually deficient the U.S. foreign policy establishment has ever been? Like, I talk about this all the time. I find myself getting bored with
it. Talk about a high bar.
I know. It's just like we have so, like, this, all of this is so obvious. The United States' declining position is so obvious. China is obviously going to integrate with Taiwan in some way, shape, or form. The United States is not going to fight World War III over it. The various things that the United States has done is going to encourage Chinese self-sufficiency. It's not even like that interesting to talk about because it's so obvious and dull. Yet the U.S. foreign policy establishment is just, I don't know. I think like the best and the brightest don't go into it any longer, to be honest. I think the best and the brightest go into like high finance and maybe
tech. Yeah, they're running hedge funds.
Yeah, it's like in the 50s and 60s, like some of our brightest minds really did go into foreign policy analysis coming out of World War II. It's just like low level shit, you know, like it's boring and people aren't sophisticated and they're not that interesting. And the obvious things are happening because they are obvious. And so I talk about this on the show sometimes. I find myself getting a little bit bored with like what DC says, because like the writing is on the wall for basically every major structural transformation. They pretend like it's not, then it happens. And then they don't change their thinking. And it's just kind of boring. So I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up because like everything that we're saying is so obvious. Duh. You know, duh, this is going to happen. Duh, China's going to do this. Duh, the United States is going to retreat from the region. Retreat isn't even the right word but you know what I mean. But yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to bring that up. It seems low level stuff right now.
It's an interesting point you're making. You know, this book, I think it's called Breakneck, that's gotten a lot of attention by a guy named Dan. It's pronounced either Wong or Wang. Maybe that's all wrong. Everything I just said is wrong. But it's about... Now, part of the thesis is China is a culture of engineers, and even the government is staffed by engineers.
Oh, yeah, this book,
we are
yeah.
a culture of lawyers. And it's interesting.
I love making
because,
gigantic claims about culture. It's so stupid.
No, but it's
stupid.
Relevant. It's interesting what you're saying. Like,
I know what
if
you're
you
saying. They're talking about the elite.
Yeah. Some of America's finest minds 40, 50 years ago did go into law and finance. Now, some of them still go into finance, but... They're not like the networkers who wind up going into politics. They're like the nerds. They're like
they're math
like
guys who are making money off of fake money. Yeah.
And
So,
although actually he might have gone into politics anyway.
No, I think he would have been a Zuckerberg. I mean, very unlikable people, you know, just on a personal level, like unlikable. I mean, a lot of these people are extraordinarily I'm going to say the word again, unlikable. And it becomes clear. I mean, they're not used to it because everyone in their life tells them that they're geniuses because everyone in their life relies on them for money. But these are like, you know, bad politicians, bad future politicians. Remember when Zuckerberg tried to do it? And everone's like, everyone just hates you.
When people were seriously saying he may run for president? Do you remember that?
No,
it was a moment.
Yeah, like 10 years ago.
He was touring
yeah.
America. He was having his picture taken with sheep.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
He was
on
like
farms.
Visiting
that was so
farms.
Good.
Yeah, no, but I do think like it's a particularly low intellectual level right now. It really is.
Back to your point about self-sufficiency in the chip industry and who's more likely to get there. Like, this has never made sense to me because the U.S. is never going to be self-sufficient, or if it ever gets to self-sufficiency, it's going to take decades. At the level of raw materials, like the stuff that China really controls, like the critical minerals, the rare earth stuff that China has a bottleneck on, and the U.S. is like scrambling to find alternative sources, and you know, none of that stuff can come online for years. It doesn't make any sense to me that you're going to get into a war, like a trade war with China over, like, we're not going to let you have the finished product of this long supply chain. You can't have that anymore. As if the response is not going to be, okay, we're not going to let you have the basic materials that go right. into creating right. these things. Like, it's, you can't win that. Like, you can't win that competition with China. And it's just been bizarre to me to watch the U.S. try to engage in it.
No, it's just, you know, kind of great power solipsism. I don't want to give another cognitive empathy sermon, but yeah, I think our foreign policy establishment is just terrible at saying, well, wait a second, what would it look like from Putin's point of view? What would it look like from Xi's point of view? I mean, they just seem not to do the exercise. But what you just alluded to, Derek, is like, obviously, if you keep fucking with them, they're going to bring up the subject of rare earth minerals. And that's what they did a month or two ago. And Trump went, oh, yeah. And he backed down on the thing that had finally forced them to do that. And it's just kind of amazing. But you
it's
know,
very look, funny. He's back down across the board. Like after that summit he had with Xi in South Korea, he's like back down all over the place. Like you, to the point where you have like the Japanese government, which, you know, got a lecture from people in the administration a few months ago about, you know, you need to take a more muscular, you need to be more explicit about what you would do if China invaded Taiwan. We want a message from Japan that says, you know, we will defend Taiwan, we'll support the U.S., whatever. And then they did that. And now, like, Trump is like, you shouldn't have said that. That's going to upset my trade agreement with Xi. Like, shut up, guys. Yeah. It's been so interesting to watch because he is completely backed off.
Yeah, look, I mean, a transactional relationship with China would be an improvement over what we've had. So I hope a certain part of Trump's instincts kind of prevail here. I mean, you ask, Danny, you kind of asked, like, is it really so complicated or isn't this just the chip restrictions, obviously a stupid policy? Let me just trace out for you what the scenario is. I mean, first of all, you got to remember, a lot of these people believe, and I don't rule it out. I mean, I am a believer in the power of this technology. I'm in the quadrant or whatever it is. And on the Venn diagram, I'm somebody who believes it's very, very powerful and is very, very worried about it. And although I appreciate it can do some great and wonderful things and has done some of them for me. But anyway, the concern among the AI safety China hawks is kind of like they have this idea that AI is going to get to AGI, kind of whatever that is. But it's going to be accelerating at that point, and it's going to accelerate faster and faster. And that's not crazy because it is already increasing the rate of AI research and progress because of the help it gives software developers. It's not crazy to think that there's an acceleration. And then they think, like, so you pass through some threshold and you're moving really fast. And what that means is if you're 3 months ahead of China, suddenly you rule the world, okay? You just are swept up to this level of dominance. And it isn't just weapons. It's like you tell your AI to go, like, do regime change in China, you know, infiltrate social media, do this, do that, whatever.
Yeah, but this is fantasy nonsense.
Well, I mean,
human existence doesn't work that way. I mean, you get these sorts of claims with every major technological leap. Again, unlike many on the left, I actually do think AI is a seriously powerful technology, and many people think it's basically bullshit. I do not think that. But these are just like the fantasies you hear whenever there's a new, you know, a nuclear weapon or the printing press or blah blah blah.
You know what you need to do, Danny, is read the book "The God Test" by Robert Wright. Unfortunately,
well, it does sell books. I mean,
but you can pre-order on Amazon. That's the scenario. I mean, but the trouble is, if both parties accept this, and by the way, one thing people say about China is they are not AGI pilled. They are not yet thinking this way, whereas some people in America, national security circles,
well, AGI is effectively a god, right? I mean, I was saying this on our podcast. I think what we've seen over the last two centuries as God died, after God died in the 19th century, is the search for new gods. In the 20th century, you see ideology. You also saw in the later 20th century, the singularity. Now we're looking for artificial general intelligence. I mean, I think these are just basically searches for God. And like the search for a genuine God, they're kind of fantasies, but I understand them. They're ultimately searches for meaning, but like they're going to tell the AI to do regime change. I mean, just, it's like this, people would say similar things about like propaganda. You know, you always hear this stuff. The human mind doesn't work that way, and human society just doesn't work that way. It's not so easily managed. This is the capital P progressive fantasy, which the 20th and 21st centuries just proved wrong time and again. I mean, that's my take on general AGI. It's just a stand-in for God, essentially.
By the way, it is the singularity. That hasn't been abandoned. The singularity is the climax of acceleration of AI improvement. So they still buy that. And look, I tell you, I've been writing about technology for 40 years. I interviewed Jeffrey Hinton in 1983. And he's now considered the godfather of AI. And I'm telling you, this is for real.
Yeah, but these guys aren't like, they're philosophically unsophisticated. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. They're just like not sophisticated thinkers about certain things. They just aren't. They're not like reading the deep philosophy on this stuff. And then it's a bit of a joke, and I think it will be looked like as a bit of a joke. This is not to say the technology isn't powerful. It will. It's going to get rid of jobs. It absolutely will. It's not going to dominate the world like the T-1000, you know, whatever the Terminator thing was. It's just, it's silly. It's literally silly. It's a joke. And unfortunately, we have to take them seriously because they're very rich.
I don't think it is. I mean, my take is I don't have the confidence in any of these scenarios that some people do. But the more I look at it, the harder it is to rule out, you know, to assign like zero probability to even the extreme scenarios.
Do you think, Bob, and this is as Danny's talking about, you know, kind of poo-pooing the doomsday scenarios, I sometimes think, well, let's say like when you get people like Sam Altman or, you know, other kind of AI guys who, you know, make these public statements about, oh, I sure hope somebody, you know, regulates AI, or I sure hope we get some international governance on AI to protect us from the doomsday scenario of, you know, AGI killing us all or doing, you know, all these horrible things. It almost feels like a marketing pitch. Like, it just feels like a lame way to say, like, look at this really powerful thing I'm building. And, you know, you better treat me as an important person because I have all this power at my hands or at my fingertips. And I think to not dismiss what you're saying, but I do think like that has the effect of causing a lot of people to look at it and say, oh, come on, like come the fuck on. Like, yeah, you're just trying to, you know, you're just making a marketing pitch. I don't need to listen to this.
But I would point out, Sam Altman actually isn't saying those kinds of things. When you see those quotes, they are from a long time ago. And one of the most dramatic of the quotes comes from the time, right around the time when he was trying to lure Elon Musk into signing on to OpenAI to save the world. It was the perfect strategic thing for him to say at that point. Now, he has said some pretty dramatic things since then, but I would say with decreasing frequency. And I'd like somebody to tell me, what is the most dramatic thing he said in the last year? He's not going around saying this stuff. Now, Dario, you know, to the extent that people think, Dario Amodai is but a, well, anyway, his whole shtick is, I'm the good guy. Sam Altman is known to be a scoundrel. I am genuinely concerned with AI safety. And Anthropic does do more in the way of safety testing and disclosure. And some of that information is useful. But, you know, I just don't think it's actually true. If you look closely, that the people at the big frontier model makers are by and large saying we should be scared to death right now.
Well, Bob,
most of them have said things like that, but it's not marketing strategy at the moment.
What's a non-ridiculous doomsday scenario? Like, let's forget like AI is going to do regime change stuff. Like, what is the like the most non-ridiculous doomsday scenario?
Depends what you mean by doom. But at one end of the spectrum, things I worry about is just the impact along a lot of fronts. You know, employment, development of adolescents, and parents freaking out.
That's real. I agree with that.
But let me finish. The impact along multiple dimensions, you know, including even balance of power among nations, if there are big jumps in, but in general, that the impact along a number of fronts will be collectively so destabilizing that something really bad happens, like World War II level bad. And so that's at the one end. And
fought with drones? You mean like fought with AI robots? Like who's going to fight that war?
Just any progress. It could just make a country overconfident, you know, like and do something stupid and stumble into. I don't know. I'm just saying there's a lot of destabilization coming, and it's going to come along multiple fronts.
I agree. And maybe with that. Yeah.
And so at a minimum, my message is, you know, when people say, Well, you can't regulate us, or like Sam Altman said, like, you know, if we had to respect copyright law, or if you go back and make us paper, you know, that would slow things down. And I'm like, slowing down is a feature, not a bug. And this is where China comes in.
Because Bob, you're a communist at heart.
The response to that is, but China, we can't slow down. What's that?
Yeah, you're a communist because, like, it's not going to slow down under capitalism. So you're not going to get the world you exist as long as we have this political economy.
No, but I mean, governments can regulate things. You
but they don't. Why do you think they don't?
You can tax the data centers to make up for...
Yeah, but Bob, they haven't for 50 fucking years. I mean, like it's not 1955 any longer. It's just not going to happen.
Whereas your vision, Danny, the things you advocate have been entirely realized, right?
My vision is mutual ruin.
Let's face it.
My vision is we're going to like kill the planet because of capitalism. That's what I actually think.
Right, but you still advocate the policies that apparently you have no reason to believe will actually be enacted. That's what we do.
But that's why you should just come over to our side. You just haven't realized it. You just haven't embraced your full socialist nature yet, because the world you're existing, you're proposing is certainly not going to exist under this political economy. There's zero chance.
I think this is exactly the moment. Now, this is the capitalist in me coming out. This is exactly the moment to go into overtime. We got them on the edge of the seat. They're reaching for the credit card, right? And just exploit the shit out of them, right?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of them are tech workers. I wonder what I bet you, I guess it's all, I do wonder the sort of class composition of listeners. It would be interesting. But I would imagine heavily male, but class, I don't know.
I don't know. Bob might have a more gender balanced audience than our show does.
You think? I'd like you to elaborate on that in overtime, Derek. Not now.
Yeah, I don't really have anything else to say.
I'm kind of afraid of what I'll hear, but I might like it. Who knows? So here's the deal: paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter or American Prestige can watch the rest of this conversation. And also can, of course, set up this special feed that will always have the bonus content from the respective podcast. This podcast appears on both feeds. Just further paywall bait. I will again, as I did last time, complain about something you said about me on your podcast. I mean,
I'm glad you're listening.
I sometimes think. I'm not listening. I have a whole large language model devoted to monitoring what you
really?
Say about.
No, that's no, it's funny. Listening. When I listen to you and Paul, that's the only time when I want to jump in. I listen to you and Paul Bloom. I'm like, no. That's the only time.
You guys want to argue with me? Well, you have way too much faith in
psychology. I mean, like it's this faith in psychology, which I just think is totally unwarranted. And general faith in social science. And then I get back to my first book was really about the history of social science. And so whenever I hear social scientific claims, I become very skeptical. But I do appreciate your conversations. They're very interesting. And he seems like a nice, cool guy. I like him.
Paul is cool. He's one of the most likable people in the world.
Yeah, he seems very likable. Yeah. Along with me.
We'll get into that in overtime. That's the third piece they will be.
It's like the great Seinfeld line. Seinfeld's someone's like his mother goes. Someone said they don't like Jerry, and Jerry's mother on the show goes, "Who couldn't like you?" And his dad goes, "I could see why someone wouldn't like him."
That's. I have no comment. I think you two are both very likable, actually. Viewed in the appropriate context. Viewed in the appropriate context.
Likewise, Bob.
With the same qualifier. Okay, so come along for the ride and hope to see you in overtime. But even if not, thanks for following us this far.